This podcast is produced by the St. Louis Psychoanalytic Institute, educating professionals and helping people of all ages and circumstances to understand their lives. Visit us at stlpi.org to learn more.
Tonight's movie is Vertigo, a famous film I saw when I was about 8 years old. It was confusing to me then. All I remember is Kim Novak and a black dress and her breast against the sky. You will see that scene tonight. In the meantime, I grew up a little bit, and I realized this gem of a movie is not something I can exhaust in 10 minutes or 10 hours, and you won't either, so I'll say a few things about it. I want to show you some slides of the great director, Alfred Hitchcock, and then read you something Hitchcock wrote about his boyhood. And then when Eric gives me the cut sign, we'll go to the movie. First, illusions. I know professors have talked to you before about illusions. They probably told you it's from the Indo-European word lied, which means to play. If you think about it, all these English words come from the very same term. Collude, allude, ludicrous, prelude, elude, interlude, delude. A wonderful spectrum. In my work as an analyst, it seems to me that I, as an analyst, like others here, follow our patients through this spectrum of play, illusion, delusion, collusion. Eventually, we hope to get them back to some sense of joy. Yes. Is that better? Ah, sorry. I hear the clap. There. I went through the Latin ludere, but I won't do it again, because after all, let's move on. Thank you. Eric, get his name. Alfred Hitchcock was born in 1899 to a middle-class family in East London. He became a brilliant early follower of the German films. He made more than 50 great films. One we'll see tonight, Vertigo, 1958. He'd made many before that. By 1930, he was world famous. He was brought to this country in 1940 to make Rebecca. He was raised in a Catholic school with a very severe notion of punishment I'll talk about in a minute. He's famous also, you probably know, for a story about his boyhood. When he was about six, his father, in order to punish him, had him arrested and put in jail. That's when fathers knew how to father. He told this story all his life about his sense of fear of imprisonment and danger. And as you probably know from his other films, this theme is constant. It's constant in this story, too, that we'll see tonight. Hitchcock is also famous for suspense and what might call sublimated sadism. Let me read you something he wrote about his boyhood. As a child in a Catholic school, there was a method of discipline which was called going for three. And this is what he says. Going for three, that was a sentence. And it was a sentence as though it were spoken by a judge. And the sentence then would be carried out by another element, which would mean a special priest in a special room, with the help of a rather old-fashioned sort of strop for sharpening razor blades. Only it was made of gutta percha, which is a soft black rubber. And the awful part about this, say, to a little boy of 10, was that having been sentenced, it was up to him when he should take the punishment. He could take it at the first morning break, lunchtime, mid-afternoon, or the end of the day, and always it was deferred until the end of the day. I think we know why. And then you'd go into this room, and the priest would enter your name in a book, and then grab the hand that was to be punished, and lay this thing in. Never more than three on one hand, because the hand became numb. and it was no good putting four on the hand, because a fourth one, you'd never feel it. So then they started on the other hand. And if by chance the crime was so great that you were sent for 12, I mean, that would be a terrible crime of some sort, you could have only six a day. And then the other six the following day. Well, this was like going to the gallows. And the other interesting thing, and one almost compares it with the crowds that used to watch public executions, was that if one went into this particular room, outside the door, a number of boys would gather and listen for these loud thwacks. And then they'd wait and look to see what kind of expression the culprit had on his face as he emerged. Yes, they were voyeurs. That to me is a very important story about a certain kind of sadism and suspense. And in his films, including this one of the chronic and important issues is knowing that something dangerous is about to happen. Not knowing exactly when, but knowing that it shall happen, and its horror is implicit in the story, as is the voyeurism. I wanted to show you a few slides, if I could do that now. The first slide, please. Is that focused? How's that? This is Alfred Hitchcock on the pony, about 1907. He's about 7.5 years old there. That's his father. His father and uncle ran a goods store in East London, so they were middle class. And as you can see, he was authoritative already then. This is Hitchcock at age 26. He was a stout lad, and as you know from his TV series later, it became one of his defining characteristics. He got very heavy. Already you can see he's a large person, and he's very intense, which to me is a defining characteristic of this person. Here he is at age 26 directing a German film. He spent about 2 years in Germany in the middle 20s, 1920s, learning a German art film. This is him, I think, in a snapshot directing. I'd call that a focused expression. The woman on his right is named Alma Reville. She was his fiancée, later his lifelong companion. This is Hitchcock at age 38. He's talking to or looking at the English actor John Buchan. In the original print, you have a very intense stare, which I think is characteristic of a great artist and a great director. This odd slide is Hitchcock at 50, and you can probably read it. The young woman he's sitting on is his daughter, Patricia. We'll ask for associations later to this slide. He weighed about 300 pounds at this time. I don't know why he did that. He had a distinctive sense of humor, as you perhaps remember. For example, on his tombstone, he thought they should write this, quote, "This is what happens to bad little boys." This is Hitchcock at 52. This is about 4 years before he directed Vertigo. This is in California, obviously. And finally, this is Alma, same age. She was born a day after he was born, 1899. I think she's still living. At least she was a couple years ago. This is Alma at 52 as well. A really interesting face. That's all the slides. Thank you. Before we see the film, I want to say a few things about it and then get you to it. First of all, to me, it's Hitchcock at his best. It's an opera. It is an art film. Later, I'll say something about dreams. It is a particularly consistent experience, it seems to me, and I would recommend, therefore, you understand the film as if you were drunk. Now, of course, you shouldn't be drunk, but it wouldn't hurt in this sense. Hitchcock thought about this film for many years, put it together in his mind, and then had it written. That is, he had the writers come to him with a plot. So he began with images, like a dream does, then he put a story to it. Also, one of the very famous scenes in this film is the vertigo sensation when the great actor Jimmy Stewart shows his dizziness. The camera does a very fancy zoom in, pull back. Hitchcock got that idea years before when he was drunk, recorded it in his voluminous mind, and put it to effect in this film. The actors, just to remind you who's in this great story. James Stewart plays Scotty, a detective. Kim Novak plays Madeline, a mysterious blonde woman. Barbara Bel Geddes plays Midge. She is later Miss Ellie in Dallas. Gavin Elster is played by Tom Hillmore. Gavin is a very important part of the story. And finally, the coroner is played by Henry Jones. The coroner scene comes late in the film. It is a wonderful 4-minute segment of this story, it seems to me. The music is by Bernard Herrmann, a great film composer and dozens and dozens of films. It makes this story in very important ways. Let me say a few things about the first three scenes and then I'll stop. The opening scene is not more than 3 minutes long. It is really beautifully done. It sets a rhythm of a chase, danger, and death. You may not remember this scene. I'll describe it briefly for you. Scotty, that is the main character, is chasing a bad guy across rooftops. He leaps to a roof, starts to fall, and the cop who had preceded him reaches down to help him. The cop falls over and dies, falls over the precipice and dies. That's it. You see Jimmy Stewart hanging by his fingernails in this terrible scene. The next scene is Jimmy, or rather Scotty, is in an apartment of his former girlfriend Midge, Barbara Bel Geddes, describing his vertigo. Vertigo means dizziness, but really he has acrophobia, which is, of course, the fear of heights. And as the film shows us, the fear of heights is, in fact, the fear of jumping, the fear of not that I could fall off, but that I want to jump off. And we will see this replayed many, many times in this story. Also important in this scene, early in the film, is Midge has a theory of psychopathology. Who doesn't? Well, she has one. In 1956, it turns out hers is a notion of shock followed by reparative shock. She tells Scotty, "My doctor tells me that to cure you of your vertigo, your acrophobia, you must have an equal shock." And so in some sense, Midge sets up the entire story. Finally, the third important scene is the next scene in the film. It's at Gavin Elster's office. Gavin Elster is married to a woman named Madeline. He has set up, he's called Scotty to be a private eye for him, to follow Madeline in her journeys. He's worried about her. And he talks about men who were powerful, free, and enjoy the old San Francisco. In this scene, you see Gavin Elster basically manipulate Scotty into the story that follows. Gavin Elster also talks about mental illness, because Scotty says, "Well, surely your wife is mentally ill," in that he learns she thinks she is a reincarnated person from the past. And Elster says to Scotty, "Don't you believe that?" And Scotty says, "No, she should see one of those psychologists or psychiatrist or neurologist or psycho," and he almost says psychoanalyst. But he doesn't. So let me say something about dreams, then I'll stop. Dreams are the stuff that psychoanalysts can't stop thinking about. Freud began the whole science with his reflection on dreams. This movie is all about dreams. For example, Madeline, as you'll see, lives in a dream time from the ancient California past. She tells her dreams to Scotty, who becomes a kind of do-it-yourself psychotherapist. He wants to help her with her dreams. Scotty has a nightmare. Later in the film, a very famous scene occurs when he when Hitchcock shows you this terrible nightmare. And finally, the dream is a puzzle. A dream is a rebus. We don't know exactly how to solve it, neither does Scotty. When we solve the dream, the analysis ends. When Scotty solves his dream, the movie ends. The goal of analysis is to understand dreams, and the goal of this movie is to show us the consequence of a waking nightmare. The first dream in this film, it seems to me, is the opening sequence, young man being chased. Later on, maybe later tonight with your cappuccino, you can understand this. It seems to me, later on, we understand the first dream when the analysis or the movie is finished. And that's the very same sequence we'll see tonight. I'll see you in 128 minutes. Thank you. I'll talk for about 10 minutes, and then maybe we can have some questions and comments from your side, too. When this film was shown in 1958, the audience clapped wildly just before the nun came up the stairs. I'm sure Hitchcock found that enjoyable. They thought, of course, that it was going to be a regular love story, and it's not. It's much more impressive than that, it seems to me. This is a work of art that could take a dozen different venues and turns and is open to all kinds of important points of view. Among them would be a Catholic reading of this film. I mentioned that Hitchcock was a Catholic boy. Once you're a Catholic boy, you're a Catholic, as far as I know. He was no longer faithful, I suppose, in the church, but the idea of guilt, an infinite reparation, I think, runs through this film. Also, the idea of suspense and delusion. I mean, after all, Scotty should have taken her to an ER, and that would have ruined the movie and would have been a completely boring story. He didn't do the right thing, not to mention rubbing her down and drying her clothing. In other words, as I mentioned before, it's a dream of a very powerful sort. It's about Scotty. It's also about Carlotta. And if we had more time and more speakers, we could talk about a feminist reading of this film, which would be very important, it seems to me. So I'll just say four things or so, and then turn to your questions and thoughts. First, mental disease is a terrifying abyss. How do I know this? The film tells me so. The film was made in 57, 58, the height of American Freudianism. You may recall Hitchcock had made a number of films using straightforward Freudian concepts, among them Spellbound in 1945 with Ingrid Bergman and Gregory Peck, who are two psychoanalysts, which, of course, is a very accurate rendition of psychoanalysis. We are either Gregory Peck's or Ingrid Bergman's. It's a fine film. It is nonsensical in many ways, but it's a fine film. Hitchcock, like many of the literati of Hollywood at the time, were not only familiar with Freud, they used psychiatrists as consults, as resources. Hitchcock often talked to psychoanalysts about his scripts, so he knew the jargon. However, in the film, mental illness is terrifying. As I read this film and see it, they all talk about doctors, but Gavin Elster, who is a bad man, I hope you understand, says, I wouldn't send her to that kind of place, meaning a psychiatric hospital. So on the one hand, you have Hitchcock using analysis to understand these characters, but he, I think, and at least the writers of the film, are terrified of mental illness, as is Scotty. A second theme is male power and responsibility. It could not have escaped you that again and again you hear repeated these themes, that San Francisco was great when men had power and freedom. A powerful man and a free man was the man who found Carlotta, this little Catholic schoolgirl, turned her into a mistress, got her pregnant, took her baby, and let her die on the streets of San Francisco. He was a powerful man of the ancient San Francisco past. Scotty is a man, too. Of course, Scotty is the rescuer. Scotty is the great contrast to Gavin. Gavin is an industrialist. You see this wonderful scene. His wife's shipyard is in the background. He has this marvelous sort of study office. By the way, Hitchcock so liked that office, he had Henry Bumstead recreate that office for himself in his home, point for point. Now, that suggests an identification, it seems to me. By the way, Hitchcock appears in the film at about 11 minutes. You may have seen him walk in a gray suit in front of Galvin Elster's office. So opposed to Elster is Scotty, the rescuer. But Scotty is full of delusions of all types. He's told this nonsensical story, and he kind of believes it. And then, of course, Kim Novak convinces him. She convinces him right up as soon as he sees her. And I agree with his swooning, but it's not reasonable. He's not much of a hard-boiled PI, if you think about it. He's a romantic, which makes him lovable and, of course, completely seducible, according to men of power. A third theme, female suffering and memory. This film was made in 1957. Officially, there were no feminists, except women who were aware of themselves. In a sense, though, it seems to me this film makes it quite clear that Carlotta's story is the core of the events. It is her tragedy that is repeated. She was 26 when she died. Madeline is 26 when she dies. Kim Novak was 26 when she made this movie. Exactly 26. And Jimmy Stewart was 49. There are two kinds of women, according to Hitchcock. Virgin bitches and prostitute bitches. I'm speaking for Hitchcock now. Hope that's clear. As someone said of Hitchcock, the virgin bitch is a woman who never has sex, and therefore she's terrible and painful and hurtful. The prostitute bitch has sex with everybody except you. Hitchcock is famous for his treatment of women. When he got Kim Novak to play this part, he basically sat on her, metaphorically, if not like in the slide I showed you. He made it clear that he dominated the movie. He picked out the gray suit. She didn't want a gray suit. She's blonde and didn't want to have that washed-out look. He demanded it. In other words, clearly the director has the power and force to make women do what he wants, in this case, Kim Novak. He'd wanted Vera Miles, but she got pregnant a third time. He was furious. He sent her a telegram saying, two children is okay, three is obscene. Why did Hitchcock hate women? I don't know. But he certainly, that's not a fair, why did he hate them sometimes and adore them other times? As you may remember, he had dozens of beautiful women actresses under his control and tutelage, among them Ingrid Bergman, Doris Day, Tippi Hedren, Kim Novak, and a dozen others, Diane Baker, and others. Why are women so frustrating and painful, and why do they merit hate? Well, they don't merit hate, except in the sense that their very power, their sexuality, can be terribly painful and enraging, especially to somebody who feels unavailable and ineligible to make or have access to their sexual lives. In some sense, Scotty represents that kind of man. He's a voyeur. He looks. He watches. He takes part only through his imagination until he is finally seduced. Madeline is a blonde goddess. And, of course, it's quite fascinating to see Madeline, played by Kim Novak, who also plays Judy, and to ask yourself, where is the woman in this story? The woman in the story is very much the Galeta. She is a doll made up in very particular ways throughout the story. Her accent has changed. And in some sense, it seems to me hard not to believe that Scotty is right, that he prefers Madeline to Judy, as most of us would, I think, given our culture and where we are. One of the tragedies of that story is that Judy doesn't know who she is. She's made up one way, and she's made up another way. Until, of course, she gets her comeuppance. One more comment about suppressed violence. This film also struck me in a lot of ways reminiscent of something called Ghost Dance, if I can be a bit anthropological for a minute. You may remember in about 1890s, American Indians, Plains Indians, especially Sitting Bull, put together a series of battles against the U.S. cavalry trying to free their people from absolute domination. They lost badly. They were almost wiped out. The Sioux especially created a new religion called the Ghost Dance Religion. The Ghost Dance Religion was a religion in which ancestral ghosts from the Sioux past, dead warriors, would rise out of the grave, come forth, join the living Sioux, and wipe the white men out of North America. From their perspective, that was a good thing to do. Sitting Bull and other priests, shamans, put together this ghost dance, and they told the ghost dance warriors that they would have magical power to stop bullets. I'm afraid, and tragically, many of them believed it. They got in battles with the U.S. cavalry, and of course they were murdered by the thousands. After that came a whole variety of other tragedies. What strikes me about the ghost dance is it makes sense in a context in which a great crime has been done, and there has to be reparation. The memory of the crime reappears in the ghost dance religion, the crime being the destruction of a people. So too in this film, it seems to me. The crime against Carlotta is a crime against many, many women of that time and our time. And the film, though it's directed by very powerful, domineering man, is about a woman's tragedy. And Madeline correctly anticipates that. In some sense, the film is right in its discourse about crime and its reappearance in occult religious activity. Like the ghost dance, she comes back. And comes back and represents a past that should be understood. Shamans in Korea, for example, have something quite similar. If I could say one thing about that, then I'll stop. One of my colleagues is working on Korean shamanism. Shamans are what we call witch doctors, or doctors who invoke past spirits. In South Korea, shamans speak for a certain class of person. They come out to the family, they do a seance, and they give the speech. The speech the shamans give is of those people murdered 50 and 60 and 70 years ago by the Korean police. These people have never been officially accounted for. And in a real sense, the shaman is the mouthpiece, is the voice, is the recorder of that tragedy too. And in the same way, it seems to me, again, Madeline's story has a very similar parallel. One comment about analysis. Well, what is the goal of analysis? Well, there are lots of goals. One way to say it is the goal of analysis is to help somebody like Scotty realize that his illness is not a terrifying error. There's something true in his story. As he says about the dream, there's something true in the dream, however the dream terrifies him. He is afraid of the dream. He says, "I will destroy your dream." That's not the goal of analysis. The goal of analysis includes taking dreams to be communications. What do they mean? We don't know at the beginning. We do at the end. Thank you.